Jeremiah's ministry extended for some 40 years, from about 625 to 585 BCE. About halfway into his ministry, the Babylonian Empire began expanding and threatening Israel's existence. Jeremiah warned his country about Babylon. He believed God helped him understand, and he tried to warn his people about the political situation. And as it turns out, he was right that Israel's existence was threatened. The people of Israel were in fact forced into exile. They had to depart their beloved Jerusalem in 587 BCE. There was another previous deportation, but I think that was the big one, and live in Babylon for about two generations. Jeremiah cries out because the people are not listening to him. In fact, they derided, ridiculed, and ignored him. Jeremiah is caught between God and Israel. He puts together what he hears from God and hears in his heart and all the facts and tries to warn his people. He's caught between proclaiming the truth and facing a people who do not believe him. He is between the proverbial rock and a hard place, with both a passion to warn and to teach and a people unwilling to heed his words, leaving him bereft of community. He was being accused of fake news. Most counselors I know today would tell Jeremiah the best thing for him to do would be to grieve. The beginning of grieving is very often venting. It is expressing one's anger, which might even include blaming those around one, around ourselves, as well as ourselves. This venting alone, however, counselors will also tell us, will not bring healing and transformation. For the venting to be fruitful, it needs to turn into grieving, feeling the feelings beneath the anger, and connecting to our unmet needs. Sadly, we do not witness this in the passage from Jeremiah. Jeremiah does vent. He vents. He rails against God and the people. He lets it all out. He goes on and on, actually, for chapters. In adjacent chapters, we hear these words: "Cursed be the day on which I was born," when he blames himself. "Why did I come forth from the womb to see toil and sorrow and spend my days in shame?" And in chapter 15, "Why is my pain unceasing, my wounds incurable, refusing to be healed? Truly, God, you are to me like a deceitful brook, like waters that fail." This section of Jeremiah is part of the beautiful and varied Hebrew Bible that includes lots and lots of lamentation, including 60 Psalms of lament. What I believe can be instructive for us here in the 21st century is that Jeremiah has to step back from his role as a leader. Jeremiah needs to step back from his role as a leader. When he chooses to vent about the pain in his life, he needs to step back so that he can vent, so that he can address the pain in his life. We, as part of the congregation, a congregation, all congregations, we can hold his leadership and insight as important, and at the same time acknowledge Jeremiah as a fellow sufferer who needs to take time away, take time to grieve. Pastors, prophets, teachers, leaders of all sorts need time to vent and to grieve, need to know how to step out of our authoritative role to be self-responsible, to vent with support, often from a counselor. In Jeremiah's grief, we hear about a God that is powerful, In this case, he, like a monarch or ruler over us, with the undependability of a brook that dries up. If we hold such a view of God, we too might conclude that God has failed us. If we hold an image of God over us, we will find ourselves dependent versus empowered, submissive versus able to be honest. At this point in his life, Jeremiah is attacking God out of his own pain and not because he has particular insight into God. Some months back in worship, we posited some less familiar names for God, but all come from our Hebrew and Christian testaments. Remember that? We had our paper up here on the table, and we wrote some of these alternative ways of addressing God. Here are a few of the ones that are still up on our chalkboard on our paper over in the narthex over there. Ground of being. I will become who I will become. Guiding star. The still small voice that beckons creation, mystery, and beloved community. You see, within these names, we have some verbs. The one who becomes, guides, beckons, and some nouns that suggest inspiration and warmth, such as star, creation, beloved community. I believe that our relationship to this God, our understanding of this God, will lead to healing for us and healing for the world. Our relationship to this God supports us being present to Jeremiah's lament and helps us be empathic to him, even now, so many thousands of years later. Our relationship to this God helps us hold Jeremiah and welcome him as a fellow sufferer into our community. If we believe that God calls us into relationship, into a covenant, we also have to accept that we have needs in relationship to this God. Our relationship with God must include some kind of mutuality, care, reciprocity, along with receiving God's love and loving God. In healthy relationships with humans, like Jeremiah, we can be present to and care for others when they grieve. We can hold others grieving and without taking it on as our responsibility. When Jeremiah lashes out and accuses God of drying up like a brook, Jeremiah is scapegoating God. He is saying God is not dependable. But I believe that Jeremiah's crisis was less about God's dependability and more about Jeremiah being cut off from his community. He had no people to care and hold him when he grieved. Jeremiah needed a community that could offer presence and care, which could have led to healing and transformation for him and his people. Lament and venting is the beginning of transformation, but not the end. We live in a democracy that has given us a real voice to communicate directly with our members of Congress and other politicians who represent us. And we have, many of us, I would include most of us, a privileged position within it to some degree. No one has threatened my right to vote. And we have five essential freedoms protected by our Constitution. The right to assemble, freedom of speech, to choose our religion, to petition our government, and freedom of the press. But for all these freedoms to be effective and work, we need a backdrop of truth-telling and self-responsibility. Truth-telling and self-responsibility. These have been eroding over the last several decades in political speech and deeds. The internet seems to lack the structure to call people to account around truth-telling and self-responsibility. I am worried for our democracy because there are those who profit from lies and subverting the will of the people. There is a fire shut up in my bones. I am grieving. Journalist Amanda Ripley wrote a book recently titled High Conflict. And in this book, she calls people, certain people, flamethrowers, people who profit from the chaos they help to create. Some people live in a post-truth world, meaning they spout lies, and sadly, there seems to be no moral compass in their lives to ground them and point towards the truth. A moral compass helps us know that we are not the center of the universe, that what is good needs to include others, a common good. If we lack a moral compass, it's easy to equate my good with the common good, or believe that only my good matters for whatever reason. I, for one, took heart in the last elections that many in our country wanted to win big, didn't. In fact, there were many election victories to celebrate in the name of truth, with chances for the policies that people want to be enacted in a number of states. But we feel the breath on our necks of those who wish to take away the chance to vote from people of color, choice about our bodies, whom we love, what books we and our children have access to in libraries, and more. The tools of flamethrowers, those fanning the flames of chaos and unrest, is creating fear and worry where there is little to no reason to be fearful and worried. For those who pay attention to the flamethrowers, who succumb to the narratives that stimulate fear and worry in them, the outer cortex of their brain stops working. When we are stressed and worried and fearful, we cannot think well. We can't access our compassion. We act for ourselves rather than the common good. People who live largely in the state of being that is stressed and worried and fearful are living in fight, flight, and freeze existence. It is no surprise that they become violent because of their exaggerated fears. It all makes sense. And whom do they attack? The most vulnerable. People of color and the LGBTQ communities have received their violence. Standing with the most vulnerable who have been attacked is as important and essential to democracy and to our call as Christians, I believe, as it ever was. The flamethrowers, without examining their fears, act with violence and disempower people who are simply different, from a different culture, speak a different language, have a different skin color. And it's astounding to me to see the power of fear, that when acted upon, it can threaten our inclusive democracy. Diana Butler Bass, one of my favorite people to follow in the theology world, lifts up Lawrence Glickman, who calls this current incendiary nationalist movement a backlash to progressive successes. Flamethrowers have fanned the flames of fear in people whose skin color simply has less tint, less melanin than people of color, believing that this, in some inexplicable way, threatens them, is a danger for their existence, otherwise coined as the Great Replacement Theory. And it's ironic that these invented fears in people who are largely white, fears of not having a place and rights in their own country, are in fact what people of color have in truth experienced for 400 years, when none of the five freedoms were protected for people of color: freedom of speech, freedom of press, assembly, religion, and to petition our government. Love is, of course, the answer. And while most people of faith agree with the commandment to love our neighbors, we need to face the reality of this moment and consider how to live in love, how to put love into action. I believe with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that there are really only two emotions, love and fear. Love is the emotion we feel when we can count our needs met and express gratitude and realize that we have gifts to give. We're fed, we're nurtured. Fear is the emotion we feel when we don't know how to be safe, or others have told us we're not safe, when we are ignorant and unaware of what brings health and well-being. By contrast, we have a beautiful Christian tradition in which we are called by Jesus to act out of non-violence, to act in love, and to engage in witness to the power of this love. For those of us who believe God is calling us to love, we can and must feel the fire shut up in our bones, feel our passion. And this passion can become fuel for what we choose to do, how we contribute, how we protest, how we petition government for different policies. Everyone thrives when their basic human rights are upheld. For our mental health, we can vent, that is, cry out to God and lament, sharing our pain, but we must also find love to be the fuel as we continue to work toward the beloved community, calling and emailing our politicians, sharing how we want them to put flesh on our values. We can even love Christian nationalists. We can begin by acknowledging that someone is fanning the flames of fear in them. For me, I want coal miners and I want oil rig workers afraid of losing their jobs. I want them to have meaningful work and retraining as the economy shifts away from fossil fuels. I want to create opportunities for poor and rich to work together on projects so we can see each other's humanity. I want to build every bridge possible because this kind of love is the antidote to fear, acted out in hate. With Jesus, we want to live our love. What is told in the dark, we want to proclaim in the light. And what is whispered, we want to shout from the housetops. We can love people, even those who hate, because we can understand that their hate is, in its essence, simply pain that has not been transformed. Pain that has lingered sometimes for decades. Pain that is made worse when the flamethrowers scapegoat and blame others for their pain. And we can love the flamethrowers who are also in deep, deep pain. So, to counter this, we need love. Actually, we need extraordinary love. Love that is capable of empathizing with another's pain, with what they are longing for. We need love that looks at a complexity in every situation, that doesn't create us and them. We need love that understands others' needs for safety, meaningful work, housing, companionship. We need love that comes from a place of nonviolence and peace. We don't want to take sides, as Jeremiah did, only to find ourselves in a crisis of being a prophet or a crisis of being a Christian, between a rock and a hard place. We don't want to wish shame on our adversaries, as Jeremiah did, because shame is part of the cycle of violence. When we are shamed, we try to right the wrong by proving our worthiness, often through violence. I heard one of my nonviolent communication colleagues cite a study that 100% of men in a Massachusetts prison studied, committed the acts of violence that landed them in jail because they were trying to prove their worthiness. They were trying to combat the shame they felt. We want to listen to the fire shut up in our bones, our passion, grieve all that is painful, and transform that pain so we can move forward with nonviolence, with love that is strong enough to help us love our adversaries. May love guide us when we celebrate all that is beautifully unique and diverse about our sexuality and the LGBTQ and the cis communities, both, and all that is shared in our common humanity. Amen.